From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the end of the high-rise housing project. We talk with sociologist Sudhir Venkatesh. He spent a decade studying the Robert Taylor Homes in Chicago, one of the projects now in the process of being demolished. Venkatesh has also studied gangs that operate in the project. He's the author of the new book, American Project, The Rise and Fall of a Modern Ghetto. Also, book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews two new novels about academia, The Lecturer's Tale and Meetings of the Mind. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. For the second time this month, the Federal Reserve has cut interest rates by a half percentage point in an aggressive attempt to keep the long economic expansion going. NPR's John Idstey reports.
Fed policymakers cited a further erosion in consumer and business confidence and a need for a rapid and forceful response as they cut the benchmark federal funds rate to 5.5%. That will reduce the rates on business and consumer loans tied to that benchmark. But it will take 9 months to a year for the effects to ripple through the economy. So if the country is currently sliding into recession, as some economists believe, the rate cuts are likely too late to head off the slump. Most analysts expect further rate reductions in the coming months. Though falling rates are good for stocks, there was little response to the Fed action from investors because the rate cut had been widely anticipated. John Idstey, NPR News, Washington.
Families of the Pan Am 103 bombing victims urged President Bush today to support continued UN sanctions against Libya after a court convicted a Libyan man in the bombing of Pan Am Flight 103. A Scottish court found one of the defendants guilty and acquitted the other. The judges said they accepted evidence that the convicted man was an agent of the Libyan Security Service. President Bush welcomed the verdict, but said he'll keep pressure on Libya to admit responsibility for the bombing, which killed 270 people. He also wants Libya to compensate the families of the victims. Germany has agreed to join a European Union proposal to slaughter up to 2 million European cows infected with BSE, or mad cow disease. At least 500,000 German cows will be slaughtered in an effort to increase consumer confidence in beef. NPR's Guy Raz reports.
Mad cow disease hasn't claimed the life of anyone in Germany yet, but it's ended two political careers. Last month, Germany's agriculture and health ministers resigned after beef sales plummeted here. Germany's new Minister of Consumer Affairs, Renate Kunast, agreed to join the Europe-wide slaughter after German officials confirmed a 25th case of mad cow disease yesterday. Mad cow disease, or BSE, has been linked to a fatal brain-wasting disease in humans. The entire slaughter is expected to cost European states $500 million. Farmers will be compensated the full market price for each cow destroyed. At a meeting in Brussels yesterday, European agriculture ministers also discussed the possibility of banning a widely used antibiotic in pigs. Some scientists have warned that the drugs may affect the human immune system. Guy Raz, NPR News, Berlin.
Rescue crews have pulled more survivors from the rubble left by last week's earthquake in India. The rescues came as bulldozers began to clear away some of the more dangerous wreckage. The death toll now stands at about 12,000. In stocks today, the Dow gained 6 points to close at 10,887 in heavy trading. This is NPR News. A judge in Connecticut has ordered Michael Skakel to be tried as an adult for the 1975 murder of a 15-year-old girl. Skakel is a nephew by marriage of the late President John F. Kennedy. He was also 15 at the time of the killing of his neighbor Martha Moxley. No one was charged at the time, although a golf club used in the murder was reportedly matched to a set owned by the Skakel family. Skakel has insisted that he's innocent. If the case remained in juvenile court, he'd face a penalty of no more than 4 years. If he's convicted as an adult, he could face life in prison. In Kosovo, calm is returning to the streets of Mitrovica after a second day of clashes between Albanian youths and NATO peacekeeping troops. The fighting left 13 French soldiers hurt, including 3 men struck by a grenade. Nick Wood reports from Mitrovica.
In spite of calls for calm from both Albanian leaders and the United Nations, Mitrovica witnessed another day of upheaval. The sound of stun grenades and the sight of tear gas filled the south of the city for a second day running. Three French soldiers were injured when used through a grenade next to the bridge that divides the Albanian-dominated south of the city from the Serbian north. The debris from 2 days of running battles can be seen on the streets. United Nations officials are unclear when this latest cycle of violence is going to end. They fear more protests as we near the anniversary of the killing of 9 Albanians in northern Mitrovica a year ago this Saturday. For NPR News, I'm Nicholas Wood in Mitrovica.
In stocks today, the NASDAQ Composite Index lost 65 points, or 2.3%. It closed at 2,773. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Travelocity.com, airline, rental car, hotel, and vacation reservations, Fare Watcher email, and Dream Maps. Travelocity.com. Go virtually anywhere.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Chicago is one of the cities in the process of tearing down its high-rise housing projects. They were built as a way to help people out of poverty, but many housing projects came to be seen as isolated, dangerous communities that kept people in poverty. My guest Sudhir Venkatesh has spent a decade studying the Robert Taylor Homes in Chicago, one of the projects which is now in the process of being demolished. His new book is called American Project: The Rise and Fall of a Modern Ghetto. Venkatesh teaches sociology at Columbia University. He first began studying Chicago's underground economy. One study he co-authored focused on the finances of a Chicago street gang. He got access to the books detailing its drug operation. He found that the average foot soldier in this gang's drug operation only made about minimum wage. I asked him to describe the typical foot soldier.
This person is probably just getting out of high school, or probably dropping out of high school is the more common story, usually between 16 and 18 years, and simultaneously looking to the street gang and the underground economy for a job, but also looking in the wider world of work as well for employment.
And what's the job description for that minimum wage work?
You know, it's a combination of being able to tolerate the risks of being on the street. And these are the ones that, you know, if you see footage of street corners, these are the kids that are being sent on the street to do the dirty work, so to speak. They're the ones who are transporting the drugs to customers and handling the money. They're the ones in the public eye. They're the ones really experiencing the greatest danger of anyone else in that economy, because once you get older, you really aren't on the street and being exposed to police and so on. You're sitting at home and orchestrating deals.
Were you able to figure out what the odds are that if you start off as a foot soldier making minimum wage in a drug gang, that you'll actually rise to more prominence and more money?
We did. It's about a 2% likelihood that if you start out at about 16 to 18-year-old, and again, you're making minimum wage, it's about 2% chance that you'll be able to rise to the top of a neighborhood street gang. And at that point, if you are lucky enough to become and part of the officer class or a leader, your income just dramatically increases. It shoots up to over $100,000 a year. So there's a real disparity in terms of where people start and where they end up. Very small likelihood of getting there, but it's a dream that many people hold dear in that economy.
But at the same time, you found that active gang members had a roughly 1 in 4 chance of dying over the 4-year period that you studied. So, I mean, you're talking about pretty big risks here.
I think that was what shocked my colleague and I the most out of this research, is that if you took 100 people who started the gang in any cohort in, let's say, 1990, by 1994, we would expect that 25 of them would be killed as a result of some activities that they were engaged in with the gang. That's an extraordinarily high risk. That surpasses by many degrees the risks just for African-American males in the inner city. So it's something that we should be paying attention to from many standpoints, including a public policy standpoint.
Now, you know, in terms of the expenses of, you know, gangs that deal drugs, you came up with some interesting things, that the gang that you studied employed mercenary fighters during turf wars at about $2,000 per month. Is that per month per fighter or per month for the whole group?
That's per month per fighter.
Wow. And the death of a foot soldier costs the gang about $5,000 in family compensation and funeral expenses. Was there a policy of compensating family for someone who died in the gang?
There's actually a 30 to 35 year old policy, because this street gang has been around for that time, to take care of people that die in the service of the street gang. You know, before gangs became economic entities invested in the drug trade, they would do that by trying to embrace the family and finding them jobs or doing whatever they could to help them, giving them resources. Now that they have petty cash, so to speak, they give about $5,000, sometimes more, to the family, and even on an ongoing basis try to give some money to the family of the member or to the to various kin to help them along. It's something that they take very seriously.
One of the ways the gang you studied made money was by collecting taxes from businesses that set up on their turf. Kind of sounds like the mafia.
It's a lot like the mafia, and actually, if you ask some of the older people within the gang who they took as their models, they'll either cite corporate America or they'll cite The Godfather, the movie. They really wanted to emulate the Italian organized crime trade. You know, they didn't really have a great knowledge of what that crime trade looked like in the city, but it was through these idealized depictions in film and TV that they were getting their notions. It was a strong influence. There were a number of notions that were important, not just the business aspect, but the idea that the gang was a family, like the mafia in terms of its sense of loyalty and respect for one another. So the funeral expenses were an indication of the ways in which they tried to demonstrate a familial component to their activities.
Now, one of the things that the gang you study did was actually give money to one of the tenants' groups at the Robert Taylor Homes, the housing project that you studied in Chicago. Why did they give money to this one tenant group, and why was the tenant group willing to accept it, and what strings were attached?
At the end of the 1980s, when the crack cocaine economy started to flourish in Chicago, one of the things the street gangs had to do at the very local level was to make sure that they were staying out of the eyes of police. Very obvious, but a very difficult thing to do. In public housing, they were actively trying to recruit tenants into their activities. Tenants really rejected their offers for a long time, for bribes and so on. But they were also experiencing a great deal of frustration because it was at this very time, right after the second term of Ronald Reagan, that the housing authority's budget started to decline. Their social services in the wider community were not actively reaching the public housing residents. The foundations and philanthropies weren't as concerned with supporting public housing. So a small segment of the tenant leadership decided that, well, this is our last choice to try and take care of some of our needs. And one of the needs that they wanted to take care of was making sure their kids got to school safely. Well, it just so happened that the street gang was interested in a type of public safety as well, because that helped them to sell their drugs more smoothly. So the tenants and the street gang started to engage in these community meetings where they would try and find compromises. And one of the ones that they struck was that a tenant leader would say, okay, you, the street gang leader, you can't sell your wares, sell your drugs on these corners and in front of the buildings between the hours of 3 and 7 when kids are coming home from school and playing. And you can't do it in the morning. But if you do it late at night and you do it in the afternoon, well, we'll look the other way. So there were these complicated and sort of perverse bargains that had to be struck between tenants and street gangs. And there was a lot of resistance among the tenants, but there was also an active constituency that said, hey, you know, until we get better police protection, we're going to live with this. It lets me go to work. It lets me bring my kids home every day.
Was there any disagreement among the tenants about whether it was a good idea to make these deals with the drug gangs?
There was considerable disagreement. There was disagreement almost every day. You couldn't walk down the hall and hear people debating this. But what was interesting to me is that they were doing so in a very democratic way. This was largely done at tenant meetings where people would talk about the issues. They would talk about, what did we do in the past when we had a street gang? What did we do in the past when public order broke down? Did we make compromises with the people who were actively destabilizing the situation? Why are we doing that now? And they also elected their leaders. If they didn't like the compromises that one leader was making, they held an election and they elected someone else. This was democracy at work. So in that sense, the people were approaching in a very civil way and trying to figure out what the best solution was for them.
Now, was the leadership of the gang that you studied residents of the housing project that you studied and that they operated in?
all of the leaders of the street gang had grown up in that public housing development in which the gang was situated. So you can imagine the entire building knew who they were. They had known them for 20 years, 25 years. They were related to them, some people in the building. They were their friends and nephews and so on. So it was a very, very intimate relationship between street gang members and leaders and the broader residential population.
And so did some of the residents of the housing project know some of the gang leaders as so-and-so's son or, you know, so-and-so's nephew?
Yeah, you know, looking back and trying to think about all the portraits that we had about street gangs and urban poor communities back then, you get the feeling as though it was an enemy within or some sort of alien force that came into the community from nowhere. But it was far from that. It was a group of kids who had a number of opportunities and couldn't fulfill them or chose to pursue their lives as street gang members and as distributors of narcotics and extorters and so on. And residents watched the transformation and they actively intervened through the whole process. You know, I'd have dinner on numerous occasions with families and a street gang leader would show up for dinner and they'd talk to them and they'd use that as opportunities to inveigh against that person and say, look what you're doing to our community. And, you know, they'd get in arguments and so on, but they did so with a sense of compassion and with a real sincere wish to try and steer that person away from the street gang back into the mainstream labor force and to pursue their education and so on. So it's a very complicated situation because if it was just an alien force, so to speak, they could just have these people removed from the community. But it was not. It was the children of other people in the building. It was their own children, their own kin. So it presented, it put them in a very difficult place in the sense of how do you intervene? You look at the same person in many different ways and you want to try to help them in many different ways.
Now that we're in the era when many high-rise housing projects are being knocked down, have you found that gangs that started in housing projects are having to find new power bases?
Yeah, I've actually been following where they're going once the public housing developments are torn down. And some are actually anticipating the process and seeking out territories elsewhere, sending their foot soldiers and their troops to other territories where they have friends who are also street gang leaders, or the street gangs in those areas are also in the same family of street gangs. And that's, as you can imagine, is causing a great concern for the recipient communities of public housing residents that are being relocated. It's not something that anyone had anticipated as being a problem. Everyone really thought that when you took these buildings and demolished them, that the gang and crime problem, the so-called gang and crime problem, would dissolve as well. But it's not, and it's following the movement of public housing and the reorganization of communities, just like residents, the street gangs are moving on their backs.
If you're just joining us, my guest is sociologist Sudhir Venkatesh, and he's done a study on a housing project in Chicago, the Robert Taylor Homes, and his new book based on that study is called American Project, The Rise and Fall of a Modern Ghetto. Let's take a short break here, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is sociologist Sudhir Venkatesh. His new book is called American Project, The Rise and Fall of a Modern Ghetto, and it's based on his study of the Robert Taylor Homes, a high-rise housing project in Chicago. Do you think that this is the end of the high-rise housing project era?
I think it's definitely the end of the high-rise public housing development. This is one of the signatures of modernist architecture, and apart from maybe a few developments that are going to remain in a few cities and a small number of cities like New York, for example, in which the high-rise is still present, for the most part, we're not going to see these sorts of residential communities anymore.
What's the fate of the Chicago projects?
Right now, there are about 18,000 units. That's about 51 buildings in Chicago that are now slated for demolition, 51 high-rise buildings. And the current plan that the Housing and Urban Development, Department of Housing and Urban Development and the Chicago Housing Authority have agreed on is that they're going to raise those units, all of them, and use the Section 8 program, the rent subsidies, to help people move into other neighborhoods. The plan is also stating that over the next 8 to 10 years, the places where the buildings once existed will be transformed into commercial and residentially zoned areas, mixed income areas, but that's not guaranteed. So while we've seen the demolition of these high-rise developments, we're still awaiting the plans to see what those spaces are going to look like and who they're going to host in the future.
So how many of the Chicago high-rise housing projects have already been torn down?
They're being actively torn down every day. In the development that I studied, the Robert Taylor homes, of 28 buildings, probably near a half are gone, and the rest are going to disappear probably in the next 3 to 4 years. Each one of those buildings containing 1,000 units, so anywhere from 1,500 to 2,000 people living in a building. So that's a lot of people in a short amount of time that are hitting the private housing market and causing a strain in Chicago, where there's also already less than a 1% vacancy rate.
So in the meantime, while some of the buildings in the Robert Taylor homes have been torn down, there are residents living in the ones that are standing?
There are residents living in the ones that are standing, and some buildings are more stable than others. And by that I mean that some buildings have actually been refurbished with not a lot of money. It didn't take much to make them livable again in the sense of fixing elevators and so on. And those buildings will be the last ones to be torn down. The really tragic story is that in other buildings, residents are being either shuttled about from building to building, sometimes with 2 to 3 weeks of notice, and forced to live in a place that they're not familiar with, maybe with a street gang that they haven't had any connection to, so they're placed in vulnerable circumstances, or they're forced to move out and allowed to move back in. So it's a great deal of instability that's being seen in for public housing residents who have to stay within the buildings.
Let's talk about what went wrong. What was the vision of the Robert Taylor Homes when it was built in the 60s?
The vision for the Robert Taylor Homes, like many of the other public housing developments across the country, was a way station for families who were living in areas, predominantly African American families, who were living in areas that didn't have decent affordable shelter. And these weren't supposed to be developments where people were staying for longer than a period of a few years. And that vision was actually borne out until the end of the 60s and the early 70s. You had in the Robert Taylor homes a majority two-parent families. There were as many people who were working as not working. There was a strong mix. There were people leaving. At the beginning of the 70s, that started to change. And that vision of what public housing could do in terms of a set of social supports for the poorest and neediest and the segregated in America, that vision started to crumble.
How did it start to crumble?
There are a couple of important developments that were happening that made public housing, the idea that public housing could be a way station, problematic. Perhaps the most important was the tremendous job loss for African Americans living in cities that resulted following deindustrialization, the departure of plants to areas overseas and to the suburbs and so on. The toll that took on African American families was tremendous. Hundreds of thousands of people in Chicago lost their blue-collar jobs, many of them who were living in public housing and using that as a step towards a private market unit. The second important development as people started to lose their jobs was that at the end of the 60s, there was decreasing money for community-based programs and institutions that helped African Americans to migrate and settle and to become accustomed to the city. As those institutions, which range from schools and volunteer associations and social clubs, as they started to leave the community or dissolve, and many times they dissolved because middle-class African-American families were using their resources to move out of the ghetto. So it was an effect of that as well. That had an effect on public housing, and the public housing started to become primarily situated in concentrated areas of poverty where people were working and they didn't have resources in the wider community. So those were perhaps the two most important changes that's happened in the 70s. After that, you started to see the street gang becoming more of an entrepreneurial actor, whereas once it was largely a group of youth or young adults or even adolescents that were more of a petty nuisance, now they started to become older members of the community who needed gainful employment and looked to the drug economy for that employment. And that started to place residents in a bind in terms of how they could use the techniques that they of conflict resolution and mediation and intervention that they had known for so many years. Those are becoming ineffective for this new type of street gang in their community.
And another change you write about is how the families moving into the projects had changed, that more and more of the families there were single mothers with children and single mothers who were often very young, much younger than most of the original families moving in.
That's right. The first, second, third cohorts in the early 60s and 70s, these were people who were in their 30s, sometimes in their 40s, a lot of kids. Sometimes they had grandchildren. They were all moving in, and as we're talking, they were moving out again. At the end of the 70s, the people that were moving into public housing were single mothers, sometimes as early as their teens, who didn't have the same experiences coming out of the civil rights movement, coming out of the history of grassroots community struggle that their parents and their predecessors had, and in knowing that that's what it would take to make public housing work. And they also were struggling to support their families. This was a community that was primarily reliant on public assistance. And for a short period of time, and this was a really interesting phase in many housing developments in the 70s and early 80s, when those two groups were living with one another, it was interesting to hear people talk about the types of education and consciousness raising that the older residents tried to impart on the younger residents and trying to make them understand what would make public housing work, sort of giving them a warning that in the coming years, if you're not organized and taking responsibility for your community, it just won't happen. No one else will do it for you.
Now, you say that when the Robert Taylor homes were designed, they were supposed to have shops and services within the project. What happened to that idea?
One of the first designs for the Robert Taylor homes was a series of mixed structures, some three-story buildings, some eight-story buildings, winding pathways, maybe a store on this corner, a church here and there. It was variegated. You wouldn't even been able to tell it apart from the broader community. The federal government effectively made that impossible for the Housing Authority to build in that way, because they imposed a limit, a cost ceiling on for each unit, a per unit cost ceiling that made it difficult for the Housing Authority to try and make a very interesting living environment for residents. So they had to resort to techniques of mass production, bringing in work crews and just building these concrete and steel monoliths that took a very short time to build. And it was disappointing. There was a lot of political battles. Even the elder Mayor Daley, who was not always perceived as being a proponent of African-American causes, actually lobbied very heavily not to build public housing high-rises. He wanted low-rises. He wanted a much different design for public housing families, and he couldn't pull it off. It was the political winds just didn't blow in his favor at the time.
Sudhir Venkatesh is the author of American Project. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Random House Incorporated's Delta Trade Paperback Division, publisher of Deep in the Heart, a debut novel about love, motherhood, and family. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, life after leaving a street gang. We continue our conversation with sociologist Sudhir Venkatesh. He's been tracking down people he first met 10 years ago when they were gang members. And Maureen Corrigan reviews two new novels about academia, one a horror story, the other a send-up of a memoir.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with sociologist Sudhir Venkatesh. For the past decade, he's been studying the Robert Taylor Homes in Chicago, a high-rise housing project which is now in the process of being demolished. His new book is called American Project, The Rise and Fall of a Modern Ghetto. You're doing a follow-up study now of people who were between the ages of 16 and 24 back in 1990 when you started your study of the Robert Taylor Homes. Why are you doing this follow-up study? What are you looking for?
This is with a colleague who's an economist at the University of Chicago, Steve Levitt, and I think we're interested in two questions. One is a very basic question that we don't really know, which relates to street gangs. What happens after people have had long-term exposure to gang activity, to criminal activity, at a formative period in their lives? If you see them 10 years from that date, are they working? Are they still alive? Are they in school? Are they in prison and so on? The other relates to public housing. Where do people go when they leave public housing, especially young people? So those are the two questions that motivate us. And for about the past 18 months or so, we've been trying to track down all of the 118 youth who were living in this housing development and asking them a series of questions about their lives and what they're doing. And we've found almost all of them, all the ones that are alive anyway.
Do you have a sense of, like, what proportion of these people have been able to actually get jobs in the legitimate economy, and how many of them are working in the underground economy?
We do. Part of our series of questions include job histories and employment histories. And at this moment, I think it's about 35 to 40% probably still participating in the underground economy in some way. Most of them are participating on a pretty irregular basis, a couple weeks here, a few months there, and trying to supplement their income. So it's not as though that's their sole form of income generation. The others are, you know, I don't know if you'd call this a success or not. There's only, I think, three that are making more than $30,000 a year. The majority are making around $18,000 to about $22,000, $23,000. They're living with either kin or they're doubling up and living with other families. There's a history of involvement in the criminal justice system for many of them. Their jobs aren't lasting very long. It's a very unstable pool. In terms of their access to employment, their access to education, and so on. And not a lot of them graduated from high school as well, so they don't have a skills base on which to draw to try and, you know, engage in social mobility through the economy and find better employment. These are the people, if you want to think about it, that are the backbone of the service economy. They're working in fast food, they're working in the custodial sector, they're working in the healthcare sector, but doing so in very short tenures, maybe 6 months to a year, then having to find a new job and moving from job to job.
Does your sociological research lead you to conclude what a lot of people have already concluded, which is that once you're in poverty, it's real hard to get out?
I don't think that we'd conclude that. I think we'd affirm that it's difficult to get out, but not impossible, and it's not random. So one of the questions for us is, does it matter if you were in a street gang, let's say, or heavily involved in criminal activity when you were young, in terms of your chances of getting out of the neighborhood and finding a better job? And actually, it's a pretty strong result that we have that says that if you are involved in the street gang and involved in the drug economy, you have a significantly greater chance of remaining and a fairly unstable person with more involvement in the criminal justice system, a smaller likelihood of finding an adequate job. The people who chose to remain in school, who chose not to participate in the street gang, and probably affirming an obvious point, but we can sort of prove it now, have a greater likelihood of finding a decent job in and around a livable wage, buying a house in some cases, actually having a less of a tenure with the criminal justice system, a less of attachment with the criminal justice system. So it does make a difference.
But that's not the perception from what you were saying. The perception of young people, of many young people who go into the drug business, is that that's going to lead them more swiftly to the house that they want and to the car that they want to own and to a better life.
One of the most interesting moments for me over the past year and a half or so has been to take these results and actually show them to the people who we've been interviewing and to some of the street gang members that we know. So we tell them, for example, that they have less than a 2% chance of becoming a leader, that they're not going to make more than minimum wage for their entire career as a street gang member, that if they continue to do this, they'll probably end up in jail 2 or 3 times, and so on and so on. And there's a pause. There's a pause for about 10 seconds in the room where nobody wants to say anything. And then somebody comes up and says, you know what, but I'm going to be different. It's going to be different for me. So somehow the ghost of Horatio Alger seems to enter the room and liven up everyone's spirit. And then the American dream, as far as they understand it, seems to be what they're going to be following again, vis-a-vis the street gang and the drug economy. So what we're doing now is actually talking to these youth by themselves. And when you do that, it's you know, they get sad. They get depressed in a sense. They realize this and they admit it. But it's a feeling as though, you know, if I work in McDonald's or if I work in the fast food sector, where is that going to take me in 10 years? And then they just leave it open as a question and to me. And, you know, sometimes I don't have a very good answer for that.
If you're just joining us, my guest is sociologist Sudhir Venkatesh. And his new book, American Project, The Rise and Fall of a Modern Ghetto, is based on his study of the Robert Taylor Homes, a housing project in Chicago. Let's take a short break here and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest Sudhir Venkatesh is a sociologist who has spent a decade studying the Robert Taylor Homes, a high-rise housing project in Chicago. Venkatesh spent the first few years of his life in India, then moved with his family to the U.S., where he lived in suburbs and around university campuses. He said he had to confront some of his own personal biases about poor communities when he began working in the Robert Taylor Homes.
Coming to a place like Chicago and living in a very isolated university environment around the University of Chicago, you're distanced off, maybe not spatially, but culturally and in terms of the education that you receive and that tells you don't go beyond this street, don't walk at this time of night. And so you think that there's something different going on across the street in that poor environment. And that's the kind of assumption that I carried with me in the beginning of my fieldwork and that I had to overcome, that these were dangerous areas, dangerous in the sense that people were killing themselves every day. It wasn't that type of danger, I found out, but you know, you couldn't help thinking that while based on what I knew during the course of my life in the U.S.
Yeah, there was real danger. You witnessed drive-by shootings, and gang fights, and there was a lot of drug crime and harassment and intimidation. Did you have senses developed at the beginning that helped you distinguish who you had to be fearful of because they really were a criminal and they really were dangerous, and who were really like decent people who didn't mean anybody any harm and didn't mean you any harm?
Yeah, I actually think there is a great level of danger in terms of the fact that the people are exposing themselves to enormous forms of risk and crime. But what I quickly found out and that probably helped me along the way was that people had correlative forms of resolving conflicts, of making sure that they weren't involved in conflicts, that the types of activities that they knew that could affect them, they had ways of shielding themselves off. And I think I learned some of those ways, how to read the signs on a street, how to know what was happening. Just to give you an example, during the first few months of my field work, I was standing outside with a bunch of kids playing basketball. And all of a sudden, I noticed that there were no kids standing around me. Everyone was crouched down behind either a car or a bush or a tree. I was left at the court by myself, just dribbling this basketball. And then a drive-by shooting just happened. A car came by, and people started to shoot from the car. These kids knew exactly when that was going to happen. When they explained it to me, it was a certain screech that they heard, the speed of a car coming around a corner. You know, I was standing there somewhat foolishly, but, you know, naively, just, you know, watching this all happen. They knew instinctively what to do. And I think maybe over the course of time, I learned those sorts of skills, maybe not always for dramatic incidents like drive-by shooting, but also in terms of where to walk in neighborhoods, how to understand the you know, the postures that people were greeting me with on the street, how to respond appropriately, when to act crazy, when to simply avoid the situation. But that took quite a long time.
Was there another incident after that in which you did dive for cover or hit the floor?
There was one incident that it's tough for me to get out of my head, and that was watching somebody get shot and killed in front of me as a result of a drive-by shooting. And that person, that young kid, wasn't a member of a street gang. He wasn't the target of the shooting. And I remember watching the community galvanize around that, literally at that moment, the people coming and approaching and bending over and looking at the kid. And it was incredible silence. If you could imagine an entire city street block that's thriving with activity, and bustling and people yelling and screaming and laughing and playing, all of a sudden becoming silent, you could literally hear a pin drop. And that event stays in my mind. And then people just sort of moving about on their own, very silently again, as if in a vigil. I think that was a turning point for me, because until that point I had probably carried a bit of a romantic view about this as a field worker going into this community and looking at what street gangs were doing and how exciting and racy this was. And you see something like that and it impacted the community in that way. You couldn't help but think that there's something wrong here. The task now becomes how to explain and how to figure out exactly what it is and what we can do about it.
Sociologist Sudhir Venkatesh is my guest, and his book, American Project, The Rise and Fall of a Modern Ghetto, is based on his study of the high-rise housing project, the Robert Taylor Homes, in Chicago. You're from India. You were born there and lived there until you were 4 or 5, and then you moved to the United States with your family. Do you think that being from India affected the way the people in the Robert Taylor Homes, who were predominantly or maybe completely African-American, reacted to you?
I think it did. I think it did in several ways. I came to Chicago in the late 80s after Harold Washington had passed away, and he was the first African-American mayor in the city of Chicago. And at that time, the political geography of Chicago was emotionally charged between African-Americans and whites, although there was a strong Latino and Asian presence. And I think in terms of my field work, that actually helped me out a lot. I think if I was actually white or if I was African-American, I couldn't do the field work in the same way, because I'd be brought into all of those political debates and dialogues. Because I wasn't, I was allowed to just hang out, and people didn't see that I was invested or their debates were going to affect me. So in terms of field work, I think it helped. I think also, and I didn't expect, and another assumption is that, you know, there were strong connections in the black community to the Asian community, not simply in terms of the fact that there was Asian American store owners in the community, Koreans, Chinese, South Asians, Middle Easterners, but also that people had an awareness of India as a very abstract concept in terms of their own participation in the civil rights movement and in the 70s. I'm talking about the older generation. They had read about Gandhi. They knew the relationship between Martin Luther King and Gandhi. And they asked me a little bit about that history. They invoked that history. And, you know, that's something that I didn't expect, that sort of awareness about an aspect of India that they took and made very important and central in their own lives. So how they recruited me into their lives was, I think, based on the fact that they already had a relationship with India, although it was very abstract. It meant something to them, and that's, I really didn't expect that. But I think it also helped me curry the favor of people, perhaps more so than if I was from a different ethnic group.
What about, though, the resentment that some African-Americans felt about Asian business owners in the neighborhood? I mean, I think there were some African-Americans who strongly felt that these businesses should be owned by black people, not by Asians.
Some of the hostilities that I felt because of my Asian-American identity were rooted in some of the store owners in the Robert Taylor Homes, in and around the Robert Taylor Homes, who were engaging in a number of exploitative practices with some of the housing development residents. A resident might take their food stamps, which are worth $1, let's say, and the commercial store owner would give them 50 cents. So this was an emotionally and politically charged situation. And there was times in which I was placed in the camp as being sympathetic with the Middle Eastern community, with the Asian American commercial community. The only benefit that I had was time, in that I didn't demonstrate my allegiances or alliances one way or another. And, you know, I think that in the end, that's probably what averted a lot of the hostility that I could have experienced.
So what reaction has your book gotten to the residents who you work with at Robert Taylor Homes?
The first reaction, and I think I expected this, was that shock and anger. And I say that because for 10 years, people had asked me what I've been doing, and I said, you know, I'm writing a dissertation at the university, and I'll probably write a book. And you can tell them that, and then you can come back and show them the book, and then that's something different. And I think they placed me in the context of a number of works that have been written about Robert Taylor and about Chicago public housing, important works like Alex Kotlowitz's book and Nick Lehman's work. And for them, they interpreted this as yet another example of someone representing us and without us having a voice. They may not have read it, but I think that was the immediate reaction that I received from a lot of tenants, was that I'll never get to write a book like this. Why is it that someone else will always get to come in my community? After that happened, I actually started giving some books away and doing some public readings and trying to meet with some of the residents who actually read some of the works. And it became an interesting take on the fact that they affirmed some things that they saw in the book. They instructed me as to what should have been there. It was a little better in terms of making me feel more comfortable. But the initial reaction was pretty much, they were angry, I think, to see yet another portrait of who they were.
You've spent about a decade studying the Robert Taylor Homes in Chicago, the housing project. And I'm wondering emotionally how you feel about them getting knocked down now. Do you think of that as a good thing, or are you sorry to see them go?
Yeah, when I go back to Chicago periodically, I drive by or I go by and visit families, and it's a real emotional experience, one, because of the people that I've known, and having spent 10 years, you know, many of these people took me into their homes, they trusted me with their lives and their stories, and you know, it's really sad to see them experience the types of hardships, or even if they're doing well, just to see them leave the community. Personally, it's a good decision to engage in demolition at the pace that we're doing it. There's really, really no rush to try and demolish and relocate families, and we're only causing ourselves hardships and the cities we live in hardships if we do it at this scale. I think we should step back and actually, one, figure out whether there's some areas of our large public housing developments that are viable, and if so, how can we keep them there, because the families need them more than we think.
Because there's no alternative yet.
Because there's no alternative for many of them, and because that the communities that remain an alternative are really no better than the ones that they're living in now in terms of levels of poverty and segregation. And sometimes they're worse because they're usually the farthest away from areas of job growth. So you're putting people, you're giving them yet another challenge in terms of being close to jobs and trying to improve their lives.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Sudhir Venkatesh is the author of American Project, The Rise and Fall of a Modern Ghetto. He's director of research at the Institute for Research in African American Studies at Columbia University. Coming up, Maureen Corrigan reviews two novels set in academia. This is Fresh Air. Two new books about academia have given book critic and professor Maureen Corrigan bad dreams.
The literary gimmick, when you think about it, is obvious. As obvious as that purloined letter sitting right out in the open in Edgar Allan Poe's story of the same name. just stitched the academic farce novel, popularized by Kingsley Amis and David Lodge, to the traditional tale of terror. And you'll have a viable new Frankenstein's monster of a genre that walks, talks, and makes readers laugh and tremble. It's an obvious idea because academic farce has always contained elements of horror. The luckless characters in Amis's and Lodge's books, for instance, often brood over images of the fathomless void that they'll be cast out into if they don't get tenure. It's an obvious idea to blend the two kinds of stories, all right, but James Hines had it first, and he stamped it with the mark of his own devilish humor and pitiless insight into all things academic. Hines debuted his demonic literary creation a few years ago in a brilliant short story collection called Publish and Perish. To quote one of my favorite critics, when I reviewed that book, I said, Hines must have struck a pact with the devil when he began writing these tales, because their tone is perfect. I don't know what Hines had left to barter with to produce his new, damnably funny novel, The Lecturer's Tale, but the unholy trade-off was worth it. You certainly don't have to be in academia to enjoy this book. The desperate career predicament of its main character, Nelson Humboldt, should engage any reader who's ever sweated over getting the axe at work. And if you like tales of the supernatural, well, the fearless Hines has trod where even Stephen King has dared not go. Nelson is one of the unclean, a visiting adjunct lecturer at a mythical Tony school called Midwest University. His deliverance from the limbo of his untenurable position arrives in the first chapter of the novel. While walking through campus on Halloween Eve, Nelson trips, and his right index finger is severed by the wheel of a passing bicycle. Emergency room doctors sew it on again as good as, no better than new, because what Nelson discovers is that his burning index finger has the power to bend people to his will. All he has to do is touch someone, and zap, his victim writhes and submits. At first, nice guy Nelson uses his finger for humble purposes, like getting the chair of his department to renew his contract to teach lowly composition courses. But as Nelson grows more powerful, he grows greedier. Soon, the tip of his approaching finger extinguishes or restores other people's very lives. Hines doesn't content himself here with taking cheap shots at familiar targets. The wicked virtuoso humor of the lecturer's tale derives from Hines' expert knowledge of his creepy subject. He exaggerates to great comic effect, but his portrayal of academe is always just within the range of the plausible. Here's a description of the cagey career climb of a post-colonialist scholar named Lester Antilles. In a discipline where scholarly heft was defined by being more post-colonialist than thou, Lester Antilles was the heftiest of the lot. As a graduate student at an Ivy League school, he had announced to his dissertation committee that doctoral theses at major Western universities were a primary locus of the objectifying colonialist gaze on Native subjects, and he refused on principle to participate. In practice, this meant that for 6 years he refused to take classes, attend seminars, or write a dissertation. As a result of this ideologically engaged non-participation, he was offered tenured positions even before he had his PhD. I could go on. There's the consciously working-class Brit expert on popular culture who churns out books with titles like It's Not Unusual, The Tom Jones Way of Knowledge, and the sinister Central European post-deconstructionist whose intelligence is certified by the fact that no one understands a word he says. Poor Nelson walks through this blasted landscape hoping to mediate between the canon defenders and the theory heads. Only at the very end of Hines' superb supernatural farce do we learn whether or not he'll fall through the cracks. David Damrosch, who's a real-life professor of English and comparative literature at Columbia University, also wants to be a mediator. In his new book, Meetings of the Mind, he recalls attending an academic conference in Tokyo and feeling deep dissatisfaction with the sad parodies of collaborative work that conferences have become. So he asks his three smarter and more egotistical fellow panel participants to continue to meet with him over the next 10 years to form a free-floating intellectual community and really participate in sustained scholarly dialogue. How moving, I thought to myself as I read and wrote a review of what I called this charming and brainy little hodgepodge of a book. But then that review was killed because I found out that Damrosch's book is not a memoir at all, but rather a coy send-up of the memoir form as well as the academic novel. Well, I was mad. First, because I had been duped and hadn't paid attention to all the clever clues about masquerading that Damrosch scatters throughout his book. Then I was repulsed because the other panel participants, whom self-effacing Damrosch paints as being smarter than himself, turn out to be just alternative personae of David Damrosch. And then I was saddened because I was honestly touched by the dream of collegiality and intellectual engagement that Damrosch dangles in his book. The fact that meetings of the mind is a fake speaks to how far-fetched that dream probably is. Maybe I'm guilty here of philosophizing in a self-serving way, but I wonder what it means when the two best recent books about academia turn out to be a wry horror story and a joke.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed The Lecturer's Tale by James Hines and Meetings of the Mind by David Damrosch. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, and Monique Nazareth, with Megan Howe, Anne-Marie Boildonato, and Patty Leswing. Our researcher is Jessica Chu. I'm Terry Gross. We'll close with a recording featuring pianist Lou Levy, who we just learned died last week at the age of 72. He was known, among other things, for being a great accompanist for singers. He worked with Peggy Lee, Anita O'Day, and Ella Fitzgerald. Here he is with Ella Fitzgerald in 1961.
The song a robin sings through years of endless springs, the murmur of a brook at eventide that ripples by a nook where two lovers hide. A great symphonic theme that stellar by starlight, and not a dream. She's all of thee.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873, online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN, and by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Wilmington Trust, recognizing worth in individuals and in unique programs like Fresh Air. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Jay Baker, the son of televangelists Jim and Tammy Faye Baker. Jay Baker now has his own ministry, in which he works with punk rockers, skateboarders, and other young people who don't feel accepted. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.